Center of Terrorist Law at St. Mary's University School of Law. He is currently the Associate Professor of Law and the Director of Center of Terrorism Law at St. Mary's University of Law, San Antonio, where he teaches a variety of courses, including global security and terrorism law. Internationally recognized expert in national security law and human rights, Professor Adicott not only lectures and participates in professional academic organizations, both in the United States and abroad, he is a frequent contributor to national and international shows, to include MSNBC, Fox, and the BBC. Professor Adicott holds a doctorate of judicial science and a master of laws from the University of Virginia School of Law. He also received a master of laws in Judge Advocate General School and a judicious doctor from the University of Alabama School of Law. So, Professor Adicott.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I used to have eyes like an eagle. Now it's kind of like a mole. I do have a professor of language. I'm a law professor in San Antonio, but I did do 20 years in the Federal Army. I was the senior legal advisor to all the Green Berets. So it's and also, more importantly, I have Confederate ancestors that are many a number, and so does my wife. I'm originally from Alabama, and in Alabama we have a kind of a strange way of looking at things, and Mark Twain, I think, kind of expressed it, but we have three categories of lies. There's lies, there's damn lies, and there's damn Yankee lies. And so when I was thinking about the title I would put on my paper, I thought that that would be quite appropriate considering the subject. And before we get into it, of course, we have to realize that everyone has a different perspective on things. In fact, it reminds me of a story that occurred some years ago in San Antonio, I'm told. There was a newspaper reporter that was out in Travis Park, and he saw a vicious dog that was running towards a little boy to attack the boy. And the reporter, before he could do anything, an individual pulled out his pistol, this is Texas, and shot the dog dead. So the reporter went to this man, he said, "That was a marvelous thing that I saw. Tomorrow's front page of the San Antonio Express News is going to say, man saves boy from vicious dog attack." And the man said, "Well, I'm not really from San Antonio." And the newspaper reporter said, "Well, that's okay. It'll say, Texan saves boy from rabid dog." And the guy says, "Well, I'm not from Texas." The reporter said, "Well, where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Chicago." And the reporter said, "Well, in that case, the newspaper's going to say, damn Yankee kills boy's pet." So, you know, I guess I've got some prepared remarks here. Let me just start reading some of them, and I'll probably jump in and do my commentary on my own remarks. As any serious student of history knows, depending on one's interpretation of history, there can be many versions of the past. This phenomenon is particularly evident in how many historians view the war between the states. And sadly, of course, the American people have been long subjected to a false narrative driven by panderers, self-righteous do-gooders, and ideologues of the worst sort. And, of course, if there is a false narrative, then logically there is a true narrative. And in short, as I would quote our beloved Kennedy brothers, the South was right. That is the correct narrative of the war. The Southern version of the Civil War, of course, is unique in large part because one cannot speak of it as something from the past. For many Southerners, there really are no symbols of a bygone era, in part because we stubbornly embrace the natural God-given root principles that caused our fathers to pick up their weapons, and that was the defense of our homes and our belief in limited government and self-determination. In an exhibit called The Civil War at the Atlanta History Center, a placard reads, quote, "Many Southern volunteers thought that secession was a natural right of self-determination. These volunteers felt they were fighting a holy cause of liberty, just like their forefathers had done in the Revolutionary War of 1776. But this lecture is not about the South, it's about the North, and about, more specifically, this myth we have in the version of history that attempts to justify the armed aggression of the Northern states against the Southern states. Started during the war, but clearly with the end of the war in 1865, apologists for the North were obliged to set out a clear historical manifesto that would justify the use of violence and tyranny. that caused the deaths of 700,000 Americans and crushed the very bedrock of limited government, which is states' rights. They quickly created what I term the United States democracy myth, and they cast President Abraham Lincoln as their heroic deity. In fact, Lincoln worship became so powerful a force that it now has taken the place of all else. There is little resemblance between the real historical Lincoln and the created Lincoln, a being that is so omniscient that whatever he said or did transcended time and space. One commentator once quipped that Lincoln was the only person he knew that became a Christian after he died. In fact, his wife said, when Lincoln was buried, the newspapers tried to make him out to be a great devout Christian, and people that knew him best objected quite strongly. And his wife came out and she said, well, Lincoln was a poetic Christian, whatever the hell that means. But of course, Lincoln was not opposed to using the term God, and he would weave that phrase in when it was convenient for him. But there's no evidence in any of his writings that he was a Christian. Contrast that with Robert E. Lee. Lee was asked on many occasions, you know, how do you go to heaven? And Lee, of course, was a very simple person, as all conservatives are. And he said, I can only say that I'm a poor sinner trusting in Christ alone for salvation. And there it is. It's a grace orientation to life. And in contrast that with Abraham Lincoln, who would use religion when it was, you know, when it was necessary. And we'll talk about that, of course, in a little bit. But that's not one of the myths I really want to talk about today, because that is something that will be decided at the great white throne judgment of Revelation 20, or if he is a believer, at the judgment seat of Christ. So I'll leave that one alone, but there's really no evidence. And that's amazing, because when you see great historical figures, that's the first thing I look for. You know, what's the evidence of their orientation towards reality? Because we're all riding a death train, and it looks like the train's further down the track for some of us than others. And there's no more greater question than where are you going to spend eternity? Apparently, Lincoln had no desire for those types of issues, but he was a do-gooder, no question about it, and had a very powerful lust for power, as evidenced in what he did and the things that that history has attributed to him. So, to continue with this paper, because I'm starting to ramble a little bit, anyway, there are many false narratives concerning Lincoln, and addressing, of course, any of these sacred cows is fraught with danger. Indeed, the myth that Lincolnophiles have created is so strong that the truth no longer really matters. This short paper will address four Lincoln lies. And we all know that even if you oppose Lincoln in any way, in any forum, you're subjecting yourself to great attack by individuals. In fact, when you go to any bookstore, you can't shake a dead cat without having a new book about Lincoln somewhere. Lincoln, Lincoln, Lincoln. I don't know who buys these books, but it's amazing because they all are washed in the same historical, political correctness. And even when you point out facts about Lincoln, it does nothing to the myth. The myth is so powerful that you can't destroy it. It's an amazing concept. And even the Republican Party, I've got to laugh at my Republican friends. They go, well, we're the party of Lincoln. Really? Don't you know that's where big government started? If you're the party of little government, where do you think big government came from? I always cringe when I hear Republicans crow that they're the party of Lincoln. But they're buying into the myth that somehow he's this great humanitarian, this man of justice, this man of peace that was forced into this action by the evil Southerners, and that's the narrative that's put out. And tragically, many Southerners fall into that narrative, and they bite it and eat it hook, line, and sinker. So for the remarks today, I would like to refer again, and I'd like to enter Exhibit A as a it's a magazine I picked up at the airport. It's called The Civil War from Time Magazine, the final year. Now, this book is really representative of the standard narrative given to the public about the war between the states. It really has disinformation and obfuscation. It runs through the magazine like a slithering snake across hot sand. And it's you know, just a bunch of nonsense. But, of course, the public doesn't know that. Now, when they do stick in a little bit of truth, again, the myth is so powerful that the truth doesn't matter anymore. So today I want to hit four myths, and this is inculcation. Inculcation, of course, is learning by repetition. If you've ever been in the military, you don't go out and practice for the parade and then, okay, we're going to be back on next Thursday, a week from today, and we'll do the parade. You have to do it over and over and over again. And as Rebecca West once said, she was a famous British novelist, she said, the trouble with man is two things. He forgets those truths that are too simple, and he cannot learn those truths that are too complicated. Hopefully, we're going to hit a simple truth today. And as conservatives, we like simple stuff. I'm a law professor, and I've been to many, many conferences over the years. And when liberals have conferences, they have a banner that runs from one side of the room to the other side of the room. It'll say things like the jurisprudence of education and the reform of social justice and the complications of, you know, it just goes on and on. You go, what the hell does that mean? When we have conferences, it's God, guns, and barbecue. We get it. It's real simple. But here are the four myths that I was, you know, just kind of sat down and identified as things that are just like you scratch your head and you go, what? It's a disorientation to reality. And the first one, of course, is Lincoln, the great emancipator. And I know I'm speaking to the choir here, but the war, of course, was not about slavery. It's true that the war ended slavery, but it wasn't about slavery. In fact, Lincoln himself proclaimed that this was not his aim. My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or to destroy slavery. And of course, the much-touted Emancipation Proclamation, you've got to give it to Lincoln. This is perhaps his greatest coup, because he was able to cast the war in a moral light to oppose the evil of slavery. And therefore, he took the moral high ground. Nobody seemed to care that almost 90% of the Southerners didn't own slaves, but he took the moral high ground. And that's, in my mind, is something, of course, he didn't believe in the concept. His idea for black Americans was what? What was his plan for black Americans? To integrate them into society and to help them out? No. Yeah, he was going to ship them all back to Africa. That was his plan.
Colonization,
go back to Africa. So Lincoln was a racist, as many of the great majority of Northerners were. They're racist. It wasn't about that. The Emancipation Proclamation in the book on Time Magazine, it says, quote, which freed the slaves in the southern states that had seceded. And, of course, that's all they say. Because the narrative is that he freed all the slaves, and we know that's not true. You could still buy and sell human beings in northern slave states, because some of the slave states did not join the Confederacy. Delaware did not join the Confederacy. Maryland did not join the Confederacy. And so some slave states stayed with the Union by force of bayonet in the case of Kentucky and Maryland, and, of course, other states like Indiana. They had no illusions about the power grab that Lincoln did, and you know that story, how Lincoln was able to funnel money, disband the legislature, and keep it into the Union. But this idea that the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves, of course, is false. And yet Lincoln freed the slaves myth is still out there, still taught in high schools. And so even the facts of history can't change this myth. And, of course, we know the hypocrisy. Even in the areas that the Union forces occupied, he wouldn't free those people where he could free them. So where he could free slaves, he wouldn't free slaves. Where he had no authority to do it in the Confederate States, he did it. But it was a brilliant tactical move because it took the high ground. The only other brilliant move that Lincoln did, of course, was not really his move. It was in my opinion, the absolute blundering move by our president, Jefferson Davis. Because the narrative will forever be, even though it's a false narrative, we fired the first shot. We started the war. We should have never fired those guns at Fort Sumter. Let those Yankees stay in that fort until they rot. That's what we should have done. Instead of firing the cannon, therefore the narrative goes out, the false narrative that we started the war. And that was perhaps the greatest blunder that Jefferson Davis ever did. Lincoln, of course, was trying to goad him into it and was successful in doing it. But they should have let those people stay in that harbor and let them rot until kingdom come. You don't fire the first shot. Historically, that was one of the greatest missteps that the Confederacy ever made. And so Lincoln, the great emancipator, is simply a myth. Then we have Lincoln, the brilliant politician. Oh, wow. Well, again, when the Lower South seceded, his advisors came to Lincoln and they said, look, boss, the Upper South will not secede. Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, they're not going to join. In fact, the Upper South refused to join the Lower South. They said no. Now, the myth, of course, is tied up with the great emancipator and the wars about slavery, because the standard narrative is that the South seceded over slavery. Well, the Upper South didn't secede over slavery. There were slave states that stayed in the Union, including, of course, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and, of course, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. They said, we're not joining. We're not leaving the United States of America. What caused them to leave was Lincoln's incompetence. He was warned by his advisors, if you demand troops to go down and put down the states in the lower South, the upper South will leave. And Lincoln said, oh, they'll never leave. They'll never leave the Union. That'll never happen. They will stay with me. They'll stay in the Union. And, of course, it was a total miscalculation. What drove out the upper South was not slavery. It was Lincoln. It was a call for volunteers. They basically said, we want nothing to do with a government that's going to use violence to solve any type of problem, social problem, whatever type of problem. These states have the right to secede, and we're not going to use violence to bring them back into the fold. So what drove them out was Abraham Lincoln and his incompetence. We have had states before in American history that talked about secession, Vermont, New York, South Carolina. And they were always able to negotiate something, cut some type of deal, and keep those states in the Union. But not Lincoln. Lincoln and his arrogance drove the Upper South out. And, of course, without the Upper South, the war wouldn't have lasted too very long because the main manpower sources, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Lincoln guaranteed that the war would be a long war by doing that. And, of course, Lincoln was so inept as a politician, but by the summer of 1864, he predicted his own defeat. He said, look, I'm out of here, fellows. And he wrote those notes and handed it to the cabinet members. And, of course, the victory in Atlanta gave him the reelection, which is another mistake President Davis made by changing commanders in the middle of the campaign. When Atlanta fell, of course, that was a death knell, and it reassured the election of Abraham Lincoln. Then we have Lincoln, the great humanitarian. That's another myth that we have. And, of course, this is something that's interesting. In the same magazine, and this is the tactic they use, even with Sherman, they can't admit that Sherman's a war criminal. Here's what the magazine says. It says, with Sherman, there will always be questions. Really? Is he a hero or a villain? A prophet of modern war or a savager of innocent civilians? A racist who opposed abolition and on and on and on, page 58. So even this magazine can't admit that Sherman was a war criminal. He took his 60,000-man army. As you know, he wrote a letter to Governor Brown of Georgia. He said, look, if you help bring Georgia back in the Union, kind of like West Virginia, I won't turn my army loose on your state. And, of course, the governor gave him half the peace sign. And Sherman, of course, took his army, divided it into two wings, and just started going on a spree of massive violence, which included rape, murder, larceny, black Southerners, white Southerners, killing every animal they came across, just horrible war crimes in complete contradiction to General Order 100, the Lieber Code, all the laws of civilized warfare. And the narrative, of course, the myth about Sherman is that, well, he was fighting behind enemy lines, he cut the telegraph wires. There was nobody there to fight, except for my great-great-granddaddy, the 2nd Alabama Cavalry, and some of Wheeler's Cavalry. That was about it. And if we caught one of those, I almost said a bad word, if we caught one of those people, we'd hang them on the spot. Hood had taken the army up into Tennessee, as you know. And so he's fighting this heroic campaign against women and children. Good job. And, of course, Lincoln knew about it. Grant knew about it. And under the law of war, Lincoln's responsible for all those war crimes. But something that's even more disturbing than that, other than the war crimes of Sherman and Hunter and the war policy that occurred, is the knowledge of Lincoln about our Southern POWs. Again, this myth that Southerners tortured Union POWs. The death rate in Andersonville is 25%. Anybody know what the death rate was in Elmira, for example? If you saw that history movie called 80 Acres of Hell, 25%. The death rates were approximately the same in Northern prisoner of war camps and Southern prisoner of war camps. The difference, of course, is that the death rate in Andersonville for the guards was the same as the death rate for the prisoners. We couldn't even feed our own soldiers, let alone the Yankees that we took. And yet, what was the situation up north? They intentionally starved Southerners, denied them of food, denied them of clothing in a climate that killed them. Disease was rampant, and Lincoln knew about it. It was a policy straight from Washington, D.C., to punish and to torture Southern POWs. So there's the great humanitarian. There's the great humanitarian for you. And it's simply a case of spite, evil, and horrendous conditions of the worst kind. And there's no excuse. At least the South could say, look, our death rate's the same amongst our guards. We can't even feed our own people. And, of course, another paper that I wrote some years ago about Sherman. You know, when Sherman was in Atlanta, did he send down some of his forces to liberate Andersonville? Could have done it very easily. Nope. Didn't do it. In fact, the commander there, Major Wirtz, he sent some of the thousands of the most seriously ill POWs to Pensacola, and the Yankees wouldn't take them. Sent them back. So this idea that he's a great humanitarian is a damn Yankee lie. Absolutely a damn Yankee lie. And yet, of course, Lincoln could write well, and he knew how to. He was a very slick politician, and he could parlay these things into his own design. And of course, the fourth myth, and this is the greatest of all, of course, this is the Lincoln, the savior of democracy. This myth, is the most profound. It is indoctrinated into our school children, and yet the seeds of the lie are embedded in the very words called the Gettysburg Address. I mean, when I was a child, they made me memorize the Gettysburg Address. I didn't know what it meant. Later on, when you actually read the Gettysburg Address, it's a manifesto of contradictions and absolute lies. Let's look at it again one more time so we can kind of see this, because this is kind of the speech that is pinned on Lincoln more than any other speech. It's a short speech. It says, four score and 7 years ago, that would be 87 years for you people from that are former Marines, rather. 1776, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. Now, our fathers were already on the continent, but we did bring forth a new nation, conceived in liberty, that's true, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Well, that's kind of true, but we were dedicated to the proposition of, limited government, and all men are created equal under the law. And then he starts out, now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. And then he talks about the battlefield and about the men that gave their lives that nation might live. And then he goes on to talk about, we must be dedicated here to the unfinished work, which is killing Southerners, of course, which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. And the very last phrase, though, is the most disturbing. He says, we are here highly resolved that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God, use the God word, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Now, the last time I checked, you can't have a government of the consent, because that's what he's talking about. That's what our founders brought forth. When you point a gun at someone and says, I will kill you unless you consent. It's not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, Abe. A third of the people said, no, we don't want this government anymore. So you're going to have a government of the consent by murdering Southerners. That's the government of the consent? It's an oxymoron. It's like if you're in a marriage and you say to your spouse, well, you may not leave. Well, she's going to hit you with a frying pan upside your head. It's a contract. It's a contract. And Abe doesn't seem to remember. He's quoting from the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence, of course, is exactly what we did in the Second War for Independence. We basically wrote a letter and said, we have the right to self-determination. We told the British that, we want to leave. It was not a civil war. We did not try to overthrow the Brits. We simply said we want to leave. One in the course of human events. It's a God-given right. I've seen a lot of papers about, well, do you have the right to secede or not? They cite that case of Texas versus White from 1869. I don't give a damn what the Supreme Court says. It's a God-given right, and that trumps any bunch of old buzzards sitting on a bench telling me what the price of tea is in China. It's a God-given right. So these people, agonize over whether they can find the right to secession in the Constitution. I don't give a damn. It's a God-given right which supersedes the Constitution. The Declaration of Independence was before the Constitution. It comes from God. We have the right to secede. In fact, at my law school, I have a sticker on my truck that says secede on it. Not that I advocate secession, but I want to remind the government that we have that right. We need to rattle their cage every once in a while and tell them, you serve us. We don't serve you. Yeah. So, you know, that's the greatest myth. And they, if you read the Gettysburg Address, it's a contradiction. You can't fight to kill me to have a government of the consent. That's a dictatorship. And he murdered. He's responsible for the death. Now historians have upped the number. I'll just use 700,000. 700,000 people. 700,000 people died for his power lust. He was motivated by power lust. Pure and simple. Now, of course, I sometimes listen to Michael Medved. I've been on the Michael Medved show. And I've done about 4,000 interviews in the context of various things. And every time you engage in a discussion with someone about, you know, was Lincoln right, was Lincoln wrong, and of course the answer is he's wrong, they always avoid the issue. They said, well, what are you saying? Don't you realize how great this country is? If the country had split apart, you know, what would history be? I don't know what history would be. I have no idea what history would be, because they say, well, the United States is a much better place because of Lincoln's murders and keeping the country together. Well, I do agree that God controls history, and this statement is all General Lee, and we as Southerners need to know that God controls history. But I do know that the North was wrong. Morally and legally, they were absolutely wrong. So I'm not impressed with arguments, because I can argue the other way around. We would have been a much better place off if we would have had two nations. But I don't make that argument, because I do believe as a Christian that God controls history. And God has a greater plan and a greater purpose. But were we wrong? Hell no. In fact, Robert E. Lee knew that before the war even started. He said, we're probably going to lose. And Lee, of course, if you visited his magnificent mansion, he had a lot to lose. He had a lot to lose. He was offered the generalship of the entire federal army, and he turned it down. This is what every officer dreams of. Power lust. Right there. This is, you know, it's not just a power lust. This is what you want to do. You want to get to the top of your career. He knew he was going to lose that house. He knew he would lose everything. The man had more integrity in a clipping of his toenail than Lincoln had with his entire cabinet and all their bodies put together. Yet he did his duty. I saw a great bumper sticker. You know, Lee's, one of Lee's favorite sayings is, do your duty. This one said, do, D-U-E, your duty. And that's the keystone of Lincoln, and that's of Lee. And that's why Lee is really the antithesis of Lincoln. Everything that Lincoln is, Lee is not, and vice versa. And so when these people go in this argument, that's their logical argument. They can't argue that Lincoln was a great emancipator, that Lincoln saved the Union, that Lincoln did this and Lincoln did that, because historically it's not true. But again, this myth is so strong. It is so vibrant throughout the nation that it's almost impossible to chip away at it. Almost impossible. It's in the literature, it's in the movies, it's everywhere. And the key, of course, is education. We need to educate ourselves about these things. And, you know, this reminds me of a story of an old woman she was actually in East Texas during the World War II. And she was out there living alone in this cabin. And you know, during World War II, we had a lot of German POWs that were spread across the South. They would pick cotton, they'd eat apple, you know, go out and do the apple stuff and all sorts of things. A lot of them were kind of integrated into local communities. Well, three of them one night got lost, and they couldn't find their way back to the POW camp, and they stumbled upon the cabin of this old woman. And she immediately shot all three of them dead. The sheriff came up a week later on a mule, and he said, Miss Jones, why did you shoot these three German POWs dead? She said, Sheriff, if I would have known they're German POWs, I wouldn't have shot them. The sheriff said, well, who'd you think they were? And she said, Yankees. So, you know, and it's critical that words mean things. And so when our kids learn the Gettysburg Address, it's our duty as parents and grandparents, when they get home, to deprogram them. Because that's all the schools do, is they program your kids in a certain narrative. Even the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm not telling you what to say or what not to say, but when I say the Pledge of Allegiance, I don't say one nation indivisible, because I don't believe it. I don't believe it. And see, that's almost like, oh, that's un-American. You're attacking the flag. You're attacking Lincoln. Well, look at what you're saying. The Pledge of Allegiance was created after the war. Why was it created? To indoctrinate Southerners that you do not have the right to secede, folks. So we're going to turn you into little robots. We're going to tell you what to think. The word under God was not added until, what, 1950. But I'm good with it up until the part where it says one nation under God, and I don't say a word, indivisible. I don't believe it, because we have the right to secede. That's why we have the Second Amendment. You know, I have a lot of liberal acquaintances, and they go, Adicott, why do you keep all those guns in your house? And I go, and they go, you don't need them for hunting. I don't keep them for hunting. Then they get real excited. I keep them because at 3 o'clock in the morning, the local constabulary will not be there when you need them. And I travel a lot. I've got a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old. I tell my wife, she knows what to do. We have a 2-story house, have an alarm. The alarm goes off. You get the riot control Remington shotgun. It makes a distinctive noise at 3 a.m. when you chamber the round. Wonderful, beautiful sound. If that doesn't drive them out, you get down low. When they come up the stairs, cut them in half. And then go through their wallet, get whatever cash they got, because, you know. I got to spackle and clean up the blood. You know, they're not going to do that. I got to spackle the walls, clean up the blood, and they call 911. And then the second reason I keep guns, of course, is to protect my community, my state, and if need be, to secede. That's why the founders put in the Second Amendment. As you well know, when the Constitution was first written and sent out to the 13 states, what did they say about the Constitution? Hell no, we're not signing. We're not signing. They said, go back to the drawing board. We want more protections from big government, from the government of Lincoln. We want more protections. So they had the Bill of Rights. And, of course, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution says that all things that are not specifically given to the federal government are reserved to the people of the states, respectively. So one of the good things about President Obama, it has caused a lot of people to look at the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and discover what their roots are. Because remember, as Rebecca West once said, that, you know, the trouble with man is he cannot learn those truths that are too complicated, and he forgets those truths that are too simple. So that's one of the good things. Before President Obama came along, we were being cooked like a frog very slowly. Liberties were slowly being taken away, taken away, taken away. And now, of course, with this president, we can see the danger. For the first time, you can see that there are dangerous things associated with the current leadership. And so that's one of the benefits, I think, is that people understand. They understand, or they should understand, from whence our liberties come from. And they reevaluate history, and they look at what really are the roots and the formation of what we are. And that's why the South is the salt of the nation. Perhaps that's why God allowed the Yankees to win the war. Because where would they be without us? Where does our military come from? Where does our patriotism in this country come from? The South. I always have people say, well, you know, what can I do to really show that we are Americans and we understand these concepts and fight this liberalism that's spreading across the land? I say, well, fly the American flag outside your house. Liberals don't fly the American flag. And if you really want to get them, fly the Texas flag. If you really want to piss them off, put the rebel flag outside your house. Now, outside of my house, I have a 4x6 Confederate battle flag that flies almost every day outside the house. And once in a while, I'll switch it up with the second national, the third national, the first national flag, and the POW flag and different flags. I also honor the southern states. Mississippi, hooray for Mississippi. They took a referendum some years back and voted to keep their flag. Hooray for Alabama. Alabama, that flag was created in 1896 by the son was in the legislature, his daddy was in the 7th Alabama Cavalry. He said, I want you to create a flag to honor the 7th Cavalry. And that's what they did. So if we let them identify our symbols, they win. And yes, I'm a law professor. I'm a high-profile figure. But it's like a dog. If you look at a dog, it won't bite you. If you run, it'll bite you. So I just look at these people in the eye. If you don't like it, don't look at it. I will not trade my heritage for a mess of pottage. Life is too short. When I was in the Federal Army, I had pictures of Robert Lee in my office. Oh, you'll never get promoted. Oh, well, then I don't get promoted. Don't care. What's the cost? What's the cost? And that's one of the things I can tell you straight in the eye. And as Richard knows, I was the commander-in-chief on two local Confederate Sons of Confederate Veterans, one in Charlottesville, one in D.C. And don't you think my superiors knew about it? And everybody, oh, hell yeah, they knew about it. But I didn't run from them. I'm not taking it down. I'm not taking it down. You can put me out. I don't care. Because our integrity is greater than the luxuries of life, because life is very short and you've got to do what's right. And so we have to stand up and denounce the lies. Denounce the lies about Lincoln, for example, which is the topic we had today. It's simply not true. It's simply not true. We were right. The South was right. We remain right. We do not need to be apologetic. We cannot let them define our symbols, because if we don't stand up, it'll be gone. It'll be gone. So with that, I'll take any questions, I think, because I've got to leave. I've got to go back to San Antonio in about 2 hours. I won't be able to stay for Q&A. So with your permission, perhaps I can take a few questions, and then I'll E&E, which means escape and evade. Yes, sir. Please email me, because I'm writing a book on the 2nd Alabama Cavalry right now. I'm trying to gather evidence. I've been writing it for about 20 years. It's a fascinating book, and it's, you know, it's just in my spare time, but I hope to get it out within a year or so. I've got a skeleton of the chapters already done. My wife's family was at Gettysburg. We took the kids to Gettysburg this summer, and of course, they were the 10th Alabama. And then I always joke with my wife. I say, well, now I know why we lost at Gettysburg. Your granddaddy was up there screwing around. Mine were in the 2nd Alabama in the Western Theater, but, you know, it's, I guess back to my other point, though, without us, what would the North be? I mean, really, what would this country be? They don't have any magazines called Northern Living, do they? They have no culture. They're a mishmash of people that have no orientation to reality. They don't understand the principles that made this country great. And as the good book says, without the salt, you know, it's just trampled underfoot. So, you know, we've got to remain true to ourselves and stand up for ourselves and do it in the marketplace, do it in the school, do it everywhere. Yes, sir. Well, I have not. I'm not an expert on the topic. I know of the concept, but I kind of just trump it all the way back to it's a God-given right. Whatever arguments you make, it's a God-given right. I mean, when our founders sat down, they didn't have the Constitution. They didn't. They just said, you know, what are the basic rights that God gives us? So I just go back to the roots, and I maintain that God gives us the right to come together. Now, we're not going to have a perfect nation because we're not perfect people. As long as they're operating at about 30%, 20% capacity, you know, okay, I'll stick around. I'll fight in their armies. I'll do those things. But again, Germany turned, it was a very civilized nation, and it went mad. There's nothing to say in 50 years this country could not turn into a massive dictatorship, and then we, the people, would have to do something about it. But it's good to remind the federal government once in a while. Again, big government makes little people. Big government makes little people. I don't want your damn Obamacare. I don't want anything. Leave me alone. I've been asked many times in my district, hey, you can ever run for office. I said, well, my platform will be I'll lower your taxes, increase the military and police force. Other than that, get a job. I'm not going to give you anything. I will give you nothing. The government that governs best is the government that governs least, of course. I understand we have to have certain principles, but... error on the side of limited government. I understand we got crooked capitalists, yes. And the problem with the crooked capitalists, as Lee said, when virtue is absent from the nation, when virtue is absent from the people, rather, the nation will collapse. Let me repeat that. Robert E. Lee said, when virtue is absent from the people, the nation will collapse. What's virtue? Well, as I tell my students, you know, does it rhyme with a rap song? No. It's doing a right thing in a right way. You have virtue. Lincoln had no virtue. He did a wrong thing in a wrong way. You have to do a right thing in a right way. For example, it's a right thing to get an A on my exam. If you cheat, you do it in the wrong way, you have no virtue, even if you get the A. And virtue, of course, means when you shake somebody's hand, you gave them your word. You don't need 15,000 pages of documents to back it up. I gave you my word. I will eat peanut butter sandwiches for 5 years. I'm not going to weasel out of it. It's virtue. Now, when you get a capitalist with virtue, you don't need a union. The rise of labor unions is because we had a lot of capitalists with no virtue. They just wanted 4 more blonde secretaries and 2 more yachts. I love blonde secretaries, but that's all they wanted. They didn't care about their people. And when you don't care about your people, then you have no virtue. And so when you have a crooked capitalist, you don't give them a white-collar jail cell. You put them in with Bubba. And Bubba will ask the guy, do you want to be the mommy or the daddy? I mean, that's the way it is. You've got to deter these people. Because simple-minded people, they see capitalists with no virtue, and they automatically assume, oh, well, socialism is correct. Socialism is inherently evil. God is the capitalist, folks. Thou shalt not steal recognizes the private ownership of property. And the 10th commandment is don't lust after your neighbor's property. God's a capitalist. And capitalism is what made this country great by people that have virtue. In any event, I'm starting to preach. Yes, sir, in the back.
David Crockett once said, be sure you're right first, then go ahead.
That's right.
The question I have, getting back to Lincoln in a second. You know where I'm going in a second. Once Richmond fell, he visited the White House Confederacy. If the White House Confederacy had stayed in Montgomery, do you think he would have gone down there?
Oh, yeah, Lincoln would go anywhere. He wanted to go sit in Jefferson Davis's chair. And, you know, he wanted to culminate that lust pattern that he had throughout his life. And so he couldn't get down there fast enough to rub it in. Kind of like President Obama when Osama bin Laden was dead. Well, I don't want to rub it in, but I'm going to New York to rub it in. And the personal pronoun, I. Lincoln was a very slick politician. I'll give him that. And again, his most brilliant move was really Jefferson Davis's fiasco when he fired at Fort Sumter. If I was an advisor to Jefferson Davis, I'd look, man, just cool it. Drink some lemonade. Here's some mint juleps over here. Y'all just cool it. We cannot give them this moral victory, this propaganda victory, rather.
What we should have done is what we did with David Twigsworth in San Antonio 2 months earlier.
Well, yeah, I mean, you do it. If they won't give up the fort, you can starve them out. And if they resupply it, who cares? You've got a small garrison there. It's inconsequential compared to the false narrative that we started the war. It was bad because that was the rallying cry for many Northern soldiers, and they don't care about black people. It's just that we're going to save the Union. The evil Southerners have started a war. It was just dumb, absolutely dumb. Yes, sir.
Would you be able to explain why Lincoln tried to recruit Grimaldi from Italy to be the head of U.S. forces?
Why did he try to recruit Lee? Oh, Garibaldi. I don't know. I don't know any information on that. I do know, of course, that he tried to recruit Lee because Winfield Scott said he's the best general, best officer in the army that we have. And of course, which is another myth, people talk about, Grant, which I wish I had time to talk about Grant. Just do a thought experiment. Suppose Grant had Lee's army and Lee had Grant's army. How long do you think it would take him to break them? about a day. Yeah, well, again, I think that's we all understand that Lincoln used that to his advantage. And again, slavery is an evil. I mean, Lee, all our great leaders recognized it was an evil. And it would have died a natural death, as it did everywhere else throughout the world. But, the false narrative was out there. The Emancipation Proclamation was that second false narrative. Southerners are fighting to preserve slavery. And we had some good generals that tried to, arm our black Southerners, put them in the ranks, and some of the racists, just wouldn't let it happen. Yes, sir, in the back.
You say you have a bumper sticker that says secede, and yet at the same time you say, I don't necessarily believe that, but it's useful for rattling the cage.
Yes.
Or does it mean other alternatives?
Well, yeah, I don't advocate secession, but I put the sticker on there because that's what our founders advocated. Most people aren't that bright. You can have a bumper sticker that says nullification. They go, what the hell is that? Is that a new store next to Home Depot? They understand secede. And if they want to interpret it in a way that someone's going to shoot me, oh, well. That's basically what I... Yes, sir. Yeah.
With the media, can you give us some advice when you go into an interview, particularly on topics that are so ingrained like Lincoln? What's the number one thing that we need to remember when we're in the same situation before the media? What advice can you give us?
I like shock and awe. I just tell them what it is. Both barrels, here's what it is. I was on MSNBC and they had the producer one time come in New York. She said, you can't say that. I said, well, then I'm gone. I like my military language better. I have more law degrees than the Pope's got liver pills, but and I have a lot of law. You know, we could say, for example, in the military language communicates better. You could say to your troops, men, let's ambulate up that enclave. Or you say, get your ass up the hill. It communicates better. And we understand that. So I tend to shift towards my military vocabulary, but I do have my professor vocabulary. Yes, sir. Well, again, you know, all the words are nice. In fact, when we fought the British, we were the rebels. We were the traitors. If we would have lost that war, the founders would all be executed. It depends on who wins, because when you win the war, you can rewrite that stuff any way you want to rewrite it. So it really depends on a force of arm, because Lincoln seems to miss this point. How was the United States formed? By revolution, by guns, picking up guns. He seems to kind of ignore that thing entirely. He borrows from the Declaration of Independence in the Gettysburg Address, but to his own benefit. As we know, the devil can quote scripture. I legally, we had the right to secede. But if you don't have the guns to back it up, you can talk about legally I have the right to do this all day long. In Tiananmen Square, you know, they went out to the Tiananmen Square, they're the Chinese, to try to protest and overthrow the government. They mowed them down. They killed them all. That's why our founders realized we've got to be heavily armed. Yes, sir.
There's, I'm not sure you're the professor, so forgive me, but there's an old common law adage that says a right absent a remedy is a nullity. So you can claim all the rights you want, but if you don't have the power to back it up, it means nothing. And that's why the appeal to secession today and the appeal to nullification today, while we are right,
yeah, now that's very true, and these are all great topics for discussion, but of course the Sons of Confederate Veterans, I mean, our organization honors our forefathers who actually had to face these difficult questions. What are we going to do? You know, what shall we do, and what do we root our actions in? And so we can extrapolate to our own times, which is a different issue, but the things that I'm most proud of about my Confederate ancestors is that they did the right thing, and I'm sure many of them, it dawned on them as it did on Lee that we're probably not going to be successful, but we're going to do the right thing anyway. I guess if I was asked as a philosophical question, were the grievances enough for the South to secede? I'd kind of say, no, not really. You know, let's try to work on this stuff. Let's see if we can work it in a different manner. Lee was opposed to secession, as you know, very much so. But when it came to it, of course, he had to make a decision. So I think this country today, of course, is the greatest nation the world has ever seen. I don't advocate secession. I think we ought to raise hell with them once in a while and remind them, you know, the principles on which we were created. And I think that's very healthy to do that verbally, kind of rattle the saber at them once in a while. And But again, relative to any other country in the world, I mean, where else are we going to go? This is the greatest nation the world's ever seen. With all of our faults, with all of the incompetence, we still have a pivot of people that are Americans. And that's what holds us together. It's not the piece of paper. It's not the Constitution. It's the people. And the people that understand the basic principles of God, guns, I want to say barbecue, but I'll say liberty, that's what holds us together. The men that are still willing to go in the military, even though it is it's unbelievable the pressures you have to put up with the political correctness and all those types of issues. I was in the military for 20 years, you know, 4 combat operations. I always wanted to go back on Saturday night and fraternize with members of the opposite sex. You got to say that today's Army, you know, and have a beer. It was tough then. I can't imagine how tough it is today for our soldiers to serve under this type of leadership and environment. It's tough. You can't even tell any jokes anymore. No more gallows humor at all. So with that, again, I don't want to go into the time of any other speaker. I think I've done. Have I? Have we done an hour?
Yes,
sir.
How can we acquire your email address?
I do run a Center for Terrorism Law, and if you're in San Antonio, we're having a conference this Friday on the 13th, and we address the tough issues like radical Islam. You can Google me, or I can give you my card afterwards, but my email address is out there. We can put you on our mailing list to show you all the things that we're doing. But I thank you from the bottom of my heart for this organization. It's still vibrant. It's still alive. We've got to keep it alive. I think the flag program's a great idea, just to let people know. If you hide the flag, then they define the symbol. If you put it up, then you can explain what that symbol is. Thank you very much for all that you do, and thank you for having me here today.